You're on the bus.
All right. Well, good evening, everyone. At this time, at 5:30, prior to calling our public hearing, calling for a public hearing, I do want to invite all of you, legislators and community members and staff who might be joining us, to please our inaugural committee for Vice President-elect Biden sent a message asking all of us to just light a candle, ring bells, turn on your flashlights, just light up your house or wherever. And I want to encourage you to please turn on your, if you have a candle, to turn it on. As we turn these candles and lights on for unity and remembrance of those who passed away from COVID-19, 400,000 plus people. In Tompkins County, we light our candles in remembrance of the 19 who passed away in Tompkins County. So thank you for bringing a candle and flashlights and noisemakers so that we can honor those folks. I also want to take this opportunity as we hold our candles up and we let the light shine to remember the light of the lives of two Capitol Police officers, Brian Sicknick and Howard Leavengood. Brian passed away as a result of injuries sustained at the riots on January 6th, and Howard passed away a few days later for different reasons. We also want to honor and remember the four rioters at the Capitol who also passed away. So we'll take a moment of silence in honoring all of them, those six people, and the 19 folks in Tompkins County who passed from COVID-19. May they continue to rest peacefully. Thank you. You can feel free to keep your candles on. Or
you want to mention we can hear all the church bells? Pardon? You want to mention that we can hear all the church bells?
Oh, thanks, Mike. As we came in, and even sitting here now, as we were coming in, we can hear the church bells ringing outside as people joined in throughout our county. So thank you to our churches and Cornell and every place else who were ringing those bells in remembrance and honor of those folks who passed. Thank you, legislators, and thank you, our viewing public, for joining us. At this time, we have a public hearing. So I'm going to open the public hearing. It's a public hearing concerning possible submission of any New York State CDBG CARES Act funding application. Is there anyone here to speak to the public hearing? We have no public to speak to the hearing. Any legislators or staff who wants to speak to this? If not, we will close the public hearing. Public hearing is closed. And I will invite you. We will open the meeting of the January 19th, 2021 meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Roll call of members.
Henry Granison. present.
Rich John.
Here.
Dan Klein.
Here.
Ann Corman.
Present.
Mike Lane.
Here.
Dave McKenna.
Here.
Glenn Boring.
Here.
Martha Robertson.
Here.
Mike Sigler.
Here.
Shauna Black.
Here.
Amanda Champion.
Here.
Deborah Dawson.
Here.
Leslie McBean Claiborne.
Present.
13 members present.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Presentation, proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices. You would have received any communications at this special presentation. Amanda, I wonder if you would like to do the honors. Normally the chair does, but I think I'll pivot to you tonight. How's that?
Oh, well, sure. I wasn't prepared to say anything, but thank you, Leslyn. I was honored to work with Megan Barber, the director of the Community Arts Partnership. There were some wonderful, amazing applicants for this year's Poet Laureate of Tompkins County, and we had a great discussion with numerous artists and in the community, and mostly I want to let Megan say a few things and welcome our new Poet Laureate. We've really enjoyed for the past 2 years having Melissa Tuckey as our Poet Laureate, and appreciate all of her good work, and we're excited to turn it over to a new person with new ideas and bringing poetry to the community. So Megan, I'll let you go ahead and introduce her, and thank you for your good work.
Hi, Megan. Please do introduce yourself so we have it on record and the public knows who you are, and then take it away.
Okay. I'm Megan Barber. I'm the executive director of the Community Arts Partnership, and it's really good to be with all of you tonight. I'm very pleased to present Dr. Christine Catano as our nominee for the Tompkins County Poet Laureate. Dr. Catano lives in Brooktondale, and she is an assistant professor at Ithaca College, where she teaches poetry and Asian American literature. She also serves on the faculty for the MFA program for writers at Warren Wilson College. She's the author of two collections of poetry, Birds of Paradise and Sky Country, which won the Central New York Book Award. Her poetry moves both the heart and the mind. She has a calm, confident way of bringing people together around literature, and she's committed to issues of equity, inclusion, and anti-racism. We're very excited to present Dr. Christine Catano for appointment as our Tompkins County Poet Laureate. Thank you.
Yay. Thank you. Thanks,
and
Megan.
She's here with us.
Dr. Christine Catano, congratulations on being appointed as the Poet Laureate for Tompkins County.
Thank
we
you.
We are excited
Hello,
to hear from you.
All right. So I was told I could read a poem, so I will do that now. So I'm reading a poem, and it's titled Ithaca Domestic, because I wanted to find a poem that was about this area and this space. During the pandemic, I did a lot of gardening, like I'm sure a lot of people were doing. And so this is a poem that is about living here, what it's like to be here. And I think hopefully it's a poem also about resilience in some way. So this is Ithaca Domestic. By August, the nettle has hardened into stalks and grown tall enough to sting my shoulder when I pause on the stoop mid-twilight to dig my keys out of a darkened purse. Last Sunday of the month, and I rise early through the mist of late summer flies swarming in the morning's wet heat to shovel, dig, and pull. Feel for the knotted roots in the deeper earth, the soil untouched for years. Not true. Maybe no human hand, or simply not my gloved human hand, but thread after thread of living vine ravel even the darkest soil. My small actions toward wreckage, I swing my petite pickaxe, stamp my boots, hack with my rusted shovel. My earth, my responsibility, I think, and yet, sunk in the garden box, 2 feet below the lawn, I find what at first feels like a finger, a knobby digit lodged in the earth. Scooping it out around uncovers the root's full body, the size of an infant animal, white and almost chill to the touch, smooth and hard as bone, yet naked, breathing, alive.
Thank you. All right. Thank you, Dr. Catano. Is there anything else you'd like to share?
I just want to say thank you to the committee for selecting me as Poet Laureate. It's a strange time to be trying to bring people together, but I think that if anything, poetry is what can do it. So I hope to continue bringing poetry to the wider community. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you so kindly, and thank you for agreeing to serve as our Poet Laureate. Know that the invitation stands, that you can let us know and come at any time. Sometimes we do need a bit of relief to share your poetry with us, to share with us some of the work you've been doing around poetry in the community as our Poet Laureate. And we are very appreciative of you being able to do this and to represent Tompkins County in this area. So thank you again, and thank you for the beautiful poem.
Thank you.
All right. Any other sentiments from anyone else? Wait. All right. Well, thanks again, and we'll see you at another time. Just let us know. And thank you, Megan, again, for the process. Amanda, thank you for participating as the legislature on the decision-making committee. Okay, we are going to move on to, we will have an executive session tonight. Jason, are you here? Is that right? Yes.
Yes, that's correct. Yes.
So we'll have an executive session tonight, just announcing for the purposes of discussing a personnel matter related to a particular person. We'll move on to privilege of the floor for the public. Where is all the public who wants to talk to us? No? They didn't show up today and then send us any letters. Well, what do you know? All right. Municipal officials, I did see Duxon. Hi, Duxon. Happy New Year and welcome.
Hello. Excuse me. Happy New Year. Congrats, Leslin, for another year of great leadership. Congrats to you too, Shona. Let's see. So last meeting, we took care of some development issues. We move forward a developer agreement with Rinland and his group for the eastern half of the Green Street Garage. As you recall, the western portion is being redeveloped by Vicino. It's all affordable housing. This other portion, Jeff Rinland has had the air rights for quite some time, and so he is developing mostly market rate housing with 10% affordable and then another contribution to the Community Housing Development Fund. So that moved forward. We also attached, excuse me, a 30% local labor requirement, and we're looking to do that for Vicino as well. We also moved forward with development, allowing for proposals for Inlet Island, a patch of city land that that we own. We had an agreement with a previous developer in 2006, didn't go anywhere, and so we're, now that it's been rezoned and there's renewed interest, we are soliciting project proposals from everybody, from the public. Has been reported in the Ithaca Voice, two proposals have been put forward so far, and we expect more when this is a public process. We did approve the mountain bike trails in Cass Park. It's a very small beginner level trail, but good resource nonetheless. And we approved, finally allowed dogs on the commons. Leashed dogs, I should note. And the DIA will be putting out bag dispensers and other amenities for dogs. I'll note, too, that tomorrow when Planning and Economic Development Committee meets, they'll be discussing an update to the developer agreement with Ficino for that part of Green Street Garage that I mentioned. And we'll be having a big discussion on the Ithaca Energy Code supplement, the continuation of our green building policy efforts. And unlike you, we do get a lot of public input on these things. So we've had tons of emails about making it even stiffer. And so that'll be a big topic of discussion tomorrow.
Okay. Thank you very much, Duxon. Any questions for Duxon? Deborah.
Yes, thanks, Madam Chair, and thanks, Doc, for coming. I'm curious to know if anybody is proposing a moratorium on using natural gas for residential heating in the city.
Residential, not yet, but it is, you know, after we settle all this new building green code stuff, we'll be moving on to existing buildings where I suspect that will indeed be part of it.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I would urge you to make that part of your green building code going forward for new construction.
Yeah, that's that's been one of the things that the public commenters I've mentioned have been asking for. Currently, the plan is and in 2025, that would kick in, that requirement, because of the increased point requirement on our on what's been proposed for the point system. But yes, people are calling for much earlier or now, and so
please
we'll be discussing that.
All right, thank you, Henry.
Is there any time frame for when you guys are going to install the hotel occupancy tax that you just got granted by the governor?
I do not know, but that is a great question. And I'm sure that'll come up tomorrow, too, when they discuss the Ficino project. But I don't know if that.
Okay. Have you guys also done anything with the Airbnb issue? There's a regulation of them?
We have not. No. Last I checked, staff was still investigating, but we have not taken any action.
Good. Thanks.
All right. Mike Lean?
Hi, Duxon. How are you? You mentioned about the local labor requirement that's been instituted. Could you tell us, if you're able to, how local labor is defined?
It's Tompkins County and the contiguous surrounding counties.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Shauna Black? Powerful, Shauna, just powerful.
Jeez. Thanks. Hi, Duxon. Liddy Barger came into our Health and Human Services Committee meeting and talked to us a little bit about the large grant that the City of Ithaca has received in regards to the Ithaca Anti-Displacement Defense Project. And I was wondering if you have any details on that.
I don't. Okay. My colleague Laura has been hinting that there was big news on that front for months now, saying that, like some state grants, they're not allowed to talk about it until a certain point. But that hasn't happened on our end yet, so that's news to me, although I had a sense that it had something to do with that topic. Okay. I'm afraid I can't tell you anything.
I will let Laura Lewis be the bearer of that wonderful news, and I will not be mentioning that tonight at Health and Human Services.
Thank you. Martha?
I think you just did, Shauna. So.
I didn't give details.
you said the short-term rental regulations, you haven't, you're in the middle of talking about that, the city?
Yeah.
Okay. I know that the town of Dryden just recently adopted some regulations. If you want to check their website, the details. And I have to say it went through with very little public comment. So, I don't know what they did, but maybe they did it right. So it might be
awesome. That's interesting. Thank you for that. Yeah. So one reason why we've taken it slow is that the town's effort to do the same was met with severe resistance. So that's interesting that Dryden kind of sailed through. So yeah, I'll take a look. Thank you.
What kind of things are you thinking about? Do you know any details?
I don't. I know that in my personal discussion with Tom Knipe, who was working on it, was to in fact do something very similar to the town with a limit on the, I forget the technical term, but, you know, renting out an entire house versus a single room out of a house. Something enough so that people can still do it for the graduations and other big events, but without really taking away from the supply of housing.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate that, Doug.
All right. Henry, one more bite.
Yes. Duxton, you talked about a 30% local labor requirement. How did you guys come to 30%? Did you consult with local labor about the 30% amount?
I mean, to be honest, it was kind of arbitrary. It was a George McGonigal suggestion. I think it was based loosely to be lower than what we've observed from the data collection from IDA abated projects. We've had to comply with the existing local labor reporting requirement. And that reporting requirement wasn't an actual requirement on local labor, but it gave us some sense of what we could expect. And 30 was, I think, substantially below the average or the median. It seemed like a safe number.
All right.
Good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, legislators. Dutson, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good seeing you all. Take care.
Yes, and for bringing a report. Appreciate your time. Take care. All right, moving to privileges of floor for legislators. Martha Robertson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot's been going on this last couple of weeks, but I just want to talk about something so closer to home. The beginning of a new year is time for reflection, taking stock of the year gone by and wondering what's coming next. A year ago, we never would have guessed what 2020 had in store for us. So I'm kind of wondering, what will this new year, will it be any more predictable? One thing I can foresee is that a year from now, someone else will be representing the western half of the town of Dryden on this legislature. This is my 20th year on this job, and it will be my last. So I'd like to take a moment to reflect. I first ran for the legislature in 2001, the year when everything changed on a single September day. I remember on one of my trips campaigning door to door, pulling the car over so I could absorb the radio news bulletin that we'd started our attack on Afghanistan. We thought those were uncertain times. Little did we know. In two decades, you cast a lot of votes, but don't worry, I'm not going to list all of them. But one that stands out was our decision not to build a new jail for 135 human beings, 100 more people than we are housing tonight. From 2008 through 2014, we fought back on fracking with speeches, hearings, and rallies all over the state. Housing has always been an issue of equity and justice, leading, for example, to the Community Housing Development Fund and the Housing Summit in 2016. We got the Public Service Commission to approve the NYSEG non-pipe alternative, the first such gas reduction initiative in the state. On the IDA, we developed progressive housing and energy policies and made grants to child care providers to help them stay afloat through COVID. We got New York State to help us expand the airport, move the DOT from the waterfront, and pay for the third county court. But we still have the damn mandate. These past two decades have included 6 years as chair of the county legislature, three sheriffs, three district attorneys, three county administrators, something like 30 NYSAC conferences, and at least 120 expanded budget committee meetings, and a partridge in a pear tree. One other number, two, which is the number of years my husband has already been retired. We're looking forward to getting vaccinated, dragging our suitcases out of the attic, and throwing our dog into the car. We've got kids and grandkids to see, and not over Zoom. Thank you very much. I'm making this public statement to help get the word out. Anyone interested in serving our community can call me so I can tell them what a great gig this is. It's been an absolute honor to serve the people of Dryden and Tompkins County, and a true pleasure to work with everyone in Tompkins County government. Thanks for listening. Thank you, folks.
Thank you, Martha. 20 years goes by quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, and we don't look a day older, do we, Leslie?
I don't. And everything else, and thank you for sharing publicly. Thank you for sharing with us and for, you know, naming some of the highlights and the things that we have fought back against and the things that we have put in place and some of the progressive moves we've made. So thank you for doing that, and we look forward to continuing to work this year to move some more needles.
Absolutely. And it's a team sport, so it's we've done a lot together.
Yes, indeed. Don't say team and sport, Martha, because I go all the way to football.
I
and
know.
And then it's all over.
Well, we're there for the Bills. Sorry about the Bills. Yes.
Thank you. See, she's starting. But thank you very much, Martha. Thank you, you know, from all of us. You know, the time isn't up yet. We still have a whole year, but thank you for the announcement.
You bet. Thanks, Leslie.
Ann Corman, and then Rich John.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I wanted to thank you for having a very short memorial moment in recognition and honor of the 400,000 plus people who have passed away in the United States due to COVID. And also, as we remember, the over 24.2 million people who have had COVID and been affected also. And of course, all the family members for people who have had COVID or who have passed away. Mm-hmm. I wanted to thank the community for their continued patience as the slow roll of the vaccine comes out. I also wanted to remind folks that yesterday was Martin Luther King Day, and it's not just a day. You can celebrate service to your community and any day of the year. So if you haven't done so, please look to educate yourself and give service back to the community in any way that you see fit. Lastly, I just want to, on a very different note, just acknowledge one of our legislators, our vice chair, Shauna Black. It's her birthday today. And if people could unmute, and we're going to attempt to sing a happy birthday really quick and try not to break Zoom. So.
Like you made Jason pipe in. Jason, were you?
Jason, could you start
lead us?
It?
Is that why you jump right on in here?
Yep. Person, we
birthday
to you.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
And many more.
Many more. We should all keep our day jobs. Thank you. Shauna, we can't let your birthday go by without the rousing rendition of happy birthday from the legislators and county administrator. You know that. It's becoming a tradition now. Jason suffered through it, so should you. But we truly do wish you well. Thanks, Annie. Anything else, Annie?
I think that was quite enough, but thank you.
Rich John.
Thank you, Leslyn. And yeah, that was pretty awful. But anyway, happy birthday, Sean. I would mention congratulations to our poet laureate. I just think it's one more reason this is the best place on earth that we have these traditions. It's a really good one. And yes, go Bills. But what I really wanted to talk about, and my apologies to Mike Sigler because he was at a meeting where I already talked about some of what I'm going to mention. I'd like to reflect on what happened at the Capitol, and I'm sure many are just sick of hearing about it. But back in 1979, I was really fortunate. I got to serve as a congressional intern for our congressman at the time, Matt McHugh. And it was a wonderful experience. I was down there for a summer. And I see what's on television now and just recognize how different it was. I was 19 or 20. I had free run of the Capitol, of the House office buildings, the Senate office buildings. You could just walk in. You could go right up to, you know, anybody's office, and I would deliver stuff all over the place. I could go to committee meetings. And in fact, Christopher Dodd, who was a senator from Connecticut, but at the time was a congressman, mistook me for somebody else and actually spoke to me at a committee meeting until he realized I wasn't the person that he thought I was. I almost shook hands with Teddy Kennedy. Somebody budged in front of me. I went and saw the astronauts on the steps of the Smithsonian just down the way. And you could walk right up. You know, you were just there. And you could walk into the Capitol. You know, I walked into the gallery and could sit and watch debate on the floor. That's not the way it is now. And I think about it in terms of one of the classes that I teach. I teach a course on compliance, so rule systems and where do rules come from. And often rules are totally reactive. They follow problems that you have something bad happen and then you need rules to address it. And you think about the ratcheting up of security systems as a result of terrorist actions. Oklahoma City, suddenly we were far more aware of access to public buildings. There was a horrendous event over at the DSS in a neighboring county, and that brought metal detectors to our DSS and our courthouses. Obviously 9/11, a signal event, and the amount of money our government now spends on security as a result of that. But then you look at something like Richard Reed, who is the shoe bomber, and one incident, and now everybody has to take their shoes off at the airport, right? It's just an annoyance, but it is annoying, right? And the same thing with those terrorists who tried to put chemicals together on a plane. So now you can only carry up to 3 or 4 ounces on a plane. We get these rules and the increased security because of bad actors. And you can't let it go. You have to do something. You know, the physical security is necessary, but it's extremely difficult to ratchet it back down once you have it in place. And there's a few reasons for that. One of them being that then sets expectations that there will be security, and you need that security in order to be safe. But it also sets an expectation that if it's not prevented, then it's allowed. And it's okay to challenge those regulations. And if you can get away with it, you know, there. The responsibility for security has been transferred from all of us to the TSA or to the other security agencies that are responsible for enforcing the rules then. And you get people who feel completely entitled to try to break rules because they're saying, well, you know, their job is to try to impose the rules. My job as an American is my freedom. I try to break them. This is really dangerous. And of course the government has to respond to it, but you look at the television and it's good that there's troops now in Washington. In a way, we certainly want a secure inauguration, but that's not the Capitol I remember. And it's not the Capitol we want. It's really, really scary to see this much security required for us to know that we're going to be able to transfer power. There's a great problem here in that ratcheting it back down, reducing the number of rules is extremely hard because it transfers personal responsibility from the agency, from the government, back to the citizens. And how you do that, how you rebuild trust, is a really long, slow, painstaking process. I look at where we're at right now. We have so much work to do. I don't want to go on at too much length, so I'll stop, but it makes me very, very sad to see where we're at. I am glad that there's a response to what's happening in the Capitol on an ideas level, on how we can rebuild this idea of personal responsibility. But I think it's critical that we do it. And I hope we make signal progress in the year to come. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich. I'm sure a lot of the sentiments you shared, some of us join you in sharing those sentiments as well. Dan Klein and then Mike Lean.
Thank you. We have something that we do from time to time. We give out a Distinguished Youth Award, and I had the honor of being able to present the most recent one to Sophia Orell. She is a Danby resident. She's a senior at Lehman Alternative Community School. She's in a digital media technology program there. Digital media technology program at TFT Boston's Career and Tech Center. She's a member of the National Technical Honor Society. She volunteered with the Youth Bureau. And somehow she's been Student of the Month multiple times. I thought you only did that once, but apparently not. So I just wanted to congratulate Sophia and just let people know that if there is an outstanding youth in Tompkins County that you think might deserve a little special recognition, please go ahead and contact your county legislator or the legislature office. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan, and congratulations to Sophia. We continue to get these legislators, just an encouragement to all of you to remind constituents, remind people in your districts that we still honor our youth for the work they're doing and to send in those nominations. So thank you. Mike Lean.
Just a nod first to Martha Robertson and say that comes as a surprise. We a lot of us thought you'd be here forever. So, that's what a nice comment you made tonight. And Rich, thank you for what you said. That's been on my mind constantly about ever since the January 6th about what was going to happen. But I wanted to mention on Sundays on C-SPAN 3, folks that have the cable, they give American history programming, and including recently they've been doing things on the presidency. They've been showing inaugural speeches of the various presidents going back to Roosevelt. Last night I happened to watch, and they were showing the final State of the Union message by Lyndon Johnson in 1969, after Richard Nixon had been elected, he was giving this speech. I personally have always thought that Lyndon Johnson was one of the greatest presidents we've ever had. I realize many of my generation do not like him because of Vietnam, and I certainly understand that. But what he did for progressive movement of this country and civil rights in voter election, voter rights and other things has never happened as much before. But it was so interesting watching this speech, watching him call out the various people in the audience, the congressmen and the senators, speaking very highly of his opposition, the Republicans, Gerald Ford, for example, majority leader then. What a difference in the way those folks operated. And they were, you know, they didn't agree on much, but they were friendly to one another. Compare that to what we've seen recently whether it's C-SPAN or on the news as far as the the various factions in the Congress at each other's throats. I would commend that to anyone who wanted to watch that State of the Union message from 50 years ago. There's a lot to be taught to us by listening to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Deborah.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say anything, but I'd like to pick up on what Mike was talking about. I was working in D.C. for the Justice Department from 1978 to 1988. In that capacity, I at times was a legislative liaison between the tax division of the Department of Justice and the tax writing committees, and particularly the revision of the criminal code at the time and its impact on tax felonies. And I had a lot of friends on the Hill. And Mike's right. I mean, if you were there, I mean, first of all, there was no security in the buildings, really. Secondly, you could go up to a bar on Capitol Hill and see people who were fighting tooth and nail with each other during the day on the floor, having drinks together and being friendly. I'm appalled by what I see. I've been appalled for quite some time, probably since the mid-90s. Thank you, Newt Gingrich. I hope we can get back to not having America divided up into two teams and, you know, pursuing policies for the simple gratification of watching the other side squirm. But I do think that before we move on towards some kind of unity, a reunification, we do need to hold certain people responsible, because what happened on January 6th, the culmination of four long years of corruption and divisiveness and hate, the people who are responsible for that must be held accountable. I don't think it's time to turn away and say, oh, well, they just got a little bit carried away. It's just my personal opinion. But as someone who lived in Washington and left that Justice Department building every night and looked down Pennsylvania Avenue at that magnificent Capitol building, it never stopped taking my breath away. I used to almost be in tears looking at that thing. This cannot stand. We cannot let people get away with the desecration of everything this country's founded on. So I'll stop. Sorry.
Thank you, Deborah. Anyone else? I'll take a quick moment to make an announcement. Thank you all for sharing the rise in Capitol. The Capitol happens the day after our legislature meeting, and so I appreciate people taking a moment to recognize what went on and also just share a little of what used to be and what we hope will be going forward. on Thursday the 21st, actually 2 days from now, the Office of Human Rights is hosting an event. The name of it is This Who We Are? Assessing the Assault on the U.S. Capitol, a panel discussion over the noon hour from noon to 1 o'clock. There are three of us who are on the panel, along with Dr. Ken Clark. Names are going to escape me now. Anyhow, two directors of Office of Human Rights from Dutchess County and Orange County will join myself and Dr. Clark moderating as we just talk through some of what you've been talking about here tonight on the riots on Capitol Hill and where do we go from here. This is not who we are. This is not who we are as America. And how do we turn back that image? So please join us noon on January 21, on Thursday, and we'll make sure that everybody gets the link, the Zoom link, that they can join. Thank you. Henry.
I just wanted to say a couple of things. One is that I attended the Martin Luther King breakfast at GX this Saturday. It was a wonderful event. I'm sure everyone loved it. I don't know whether it's, oh, I guess it was taped because the speaker was amazing. She spoke for an hour and a half and promised to come back in the future. Leslie can, we can send people to GX to see the video. Also, I want to talk about Kirby Edmonds is having a remembrance for him on January 23rd at 3 p.m. We can post the website or whatever. But again, I wish that everyone could attend this event to remember Kirby Edmonds, who passed away early last year and left a big hole in Tompkins County. That's all I have to say.
Henry, could you give us the time and date on that again?
Sure. It's January 23rd at 3 p.m. And it's a Zoom link I can share with people.
I do believe you need to register for it, and then they will send you the link to attend. So if anybody's interested, we'll certainly send you the email for registration. You know, just hit me up and we'll make sure that happens. Thank you, Henry, for acknowledging the GX breakfast. We just got a text message that she's also covering or a big part of the Biden inauguration and doing takes us through the historic nature of Barack Obama's inauguration and the role that President-elect Joe Biden played as well. So, you know, this was a very dynamic young lady, and like you said, Henry, I hope that she will come back and we can all engage in good conversation with her. So thank you, and thank you for those of you who had a chance to attend, who were able to. It is on YouTube, so you can and watch it anytime. Okay, any other legislators? So we can move through the rest of our agenda. I know that there's some staff waiting, but I do want to get through just very quickly chair's report and chair's appointments, if that's okay. And I also saw Ruby on deck, our new HR commissioner as of this year. I know Ruby attended a meeting prior to now, but I do want to officially welcome Ruby to Tompkins County and to the role of Commissioner of Human Resources. Thank you for being here, Ruby. Thank you for sharing your face so we can be reminded you are that big smile. Welcome to Tompkins County. We look forward to working with you as an entire body, and I'm sure we'll have a chance to meet you in person
at
some point soon. So welcome again.
Thank you.
All right. Legislators, I hope to get this statement out to you earlier today, but the minutes ticked away. I told Martha the minutes just tick away, and before I know it, it's 1:30 in the morning. But indulge me, please, as I read through my 2021 statement. At our organizing meeting, you, my colleagues, voted to elect me as chair of this legislature for 2021. I want to take time now to thank you sincerely for your vote of confidence. I'm not the best leader. I would never say that I am. If I were, the world would be a whole better place. But I promise to continue to lead from a place of trust and confidence in each of our abilities, individually and collectively, that we will do what's right for Tompkins County and for our residents. This is not a job of ego or big eyes and little U's. I don't see it that way. It is one of respect, coordination, communication, and transparency to the best extent possible. I must also thank my biological family, JR, Kelsey, Julius, and Indira, and my GIAC family for the love and unwavering support that they gave me to allow me to do this work. Vice Chair Shauna Black, at our organizing meeting when you were unanimously elected as our Vice Chair for 2021, you described yourself as my wing woman, and that sat with me. I thought about it when you said it, and I wanted to disagree with you. Respectfully, I will disagree with you. We have worked collaboratively as a true team. It wasn't me and you doing the cleanup or being the wing person. There were instances when I was Robin and you were Batman. And there were instances when I was Batman and you were Robin. We set out to deliberately present a collaborative and cordial partnership. But we didn't have to work at it. It fell into place organically. We relied on each other's strengths, availability, and experience to help us navigate the work and changes that came at us rapidly, navigate those seamlessly. Thank you, Shauna, for your calm, for your conciliatory nature, your humor, and your steadfast leadership. We respected and learned from each other. And I hope that our approach this year will resonate with future leadership. That treating people right will never, ever fail you. 2020 brought on challenges, the likes of which we have not dealt with in county government. COVID-19 descended upon us like an avalanche, and we felt like our very world was collapsing in on itself. Protests erupted throughout our nation, including locally, because Black and brown men and women continue to be unjustly murdered in the streets of our country and in their homes by those who swore to protect and serve our citizens. The images of George Floyd with a police officer's knee on his neck for 8 minutes and 46 seconds until he could no longer breathe, dead, or of Ahmaud Arbery shot while jogging, or Jacob Blake shot 7 times in the back at point blank range while his children were in the car and bearing witness to it, or the reports of Breonna Taylor shot dead in her home, and countless others. These are images and reports that we cannot just forget. The rise of white supremacist groups and their encouragement by national leaders put all of us at risk. Our economy was on a high-speed racetrack to having the bottom fall out. Higher education institutions and public schools were forced to transition to remote learning. Workers were losing their jobs, and many were unsure of whether they would find work again and anytime soon. We, as legislators, had to quickly transition to remote meetings. Fear and anxiety related to all of these conditions gripped us. But the good news is that the resilience, intelligence, and talent of our workforce kept us from going over the edge. Our staff, led by County Administrator Jason Molino and Public Health Director Frank Rufa, spent sleepless nights planning and strategizing on a response plan to the twin pandemic of COVID-19 and systemic racism. They built an inclusive community partnership team, and rolled out a comprehensive response plan to COVID-19 that set the standard for New York State. We all should be very, very proud. Staff from other departments accepted reassignments, dusted off skills they might have forgotten they had, and became communication specialists, contact tracers, and more. I want to pause and thank the Emergency Operations Center leadership team, Deputy County Administrator Amy Hendricks, Communications Director Dominic Recchio, who didn't know what he was getting into when he applied for this job. I don't think Dominic has had a vacation, Christmas Day, New Year's Day, any of those days. He was working because we saw those things coming out. Director of Assessment Jay Franklin, Interim Commissioner of Human Resources Lisa Holmes, and everyone else who, without question, stepped into various roles to help manage our response to the pandemic. If we as legislators could do the work of all the staff, we would not need them. So I want to acknowledge that we have hired and have working for us a highly skilled, experienced, and future-thinking workforce who have not failed us. I applaud them and encourage us to trust that they know what they are doing. Otherwise, they will not be here as part of our team. I also want to appreciate that we listen to our staff who self-selected to take on the daily tasks associated with forwarding the county's diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice movement. They brought forward a well-thought-out and visionary proposal to hire our first Tompkins County Chief Equity and Diversity Officer, and we did so. We accepted that policy decision and we moved on it. Welcome again, Deanna Carruthers, as our CEDO. As we continue to address the pandemic of systemic racism, we look forward to your leadership and stand ready to support you in this change movement, because we acknowledge that it will take all of us. Thank you, Tompkins County staff, for all that you do. As we roll into 2021, we continue to struggle with bringing in the revenues at the levels to which we have become accustomed. They have been dismal. They have been frightening, especially our sales tax report. It will take time to recover. Despite what seems like insurmountable challenges still ahead, I feel confident in declaring that the state of our county is solid, and that is because of all of us. The work that we do and we put in, not just us legislators, but I mean the entire county government. We would love for the state of our county to be strong, but at least we know that with a solid foundation, we can build our way back to strong. We have proven that we are a team driven by principle, compassion, and hope, as is evident by our vaccination administration plan, a plan that received praise, public praise, from Governor Cuomo and many of our counterparts throughout the state. Thanks to Marty Stallone and the entire team at Cayuga Health Systems for being a steadfast partner in this plan. It's sad to see Dominic's press release that we were informed that we will not get any vaccines this week, but we hope that we'll get more in the future, that we can continue to vaccinate our public. In 2021, we must forge a new path that is based on some ongoing and some new priorities, and a path that's focused more on unity, service, and collective responsibility. Those priorities include our new Tompkins County International Airport. We all know that the pandemic has severely wounded the airline industry. Housing and particularly a push for more affordable housing, more low-income housing, quality low-income housing in our community. Police reform, reimagining law enforcement, working to dismantle old systems and giving birth to accurate responsibilities and accountability. And we're doing that work. Sustainability planning and mega attention to climate change. Our community college, strategically supporting and helping TC3 imagine its service model so that the students, and Mike Lane says this often, for whom a TC3 education is their ticket out of the conditions of poverty and oppression, can be confident that it will be there for them. Public transportation, strengthening what we already have with TCAT, that it can serve more and serve better. Economic recovery, through our advocacy for federal funding so that our local businesses can get back to growing and thriving. Last but certainly not least, taking care of our employees. As I mentioned earlier, we are no place without our employees. So it is imperative that we do our best to ensure the best working climate, resources, and compensation that we can reasonably afford to keep our employees engaged. With these priorities in mind, and considering the strengths and expertise of our policymakers, you, Sean and I have asked the following legislators to lead our committees to address the aforementioned priorities and more. Our Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, we have asked Deborah Dawson to chair, Martha Robertson to be the vice chair, Michael Lane, Glenn Morey, and Rich John to help in leading that committee as committee members. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, we have asked Mike Lane to continue chairing that committee. David McKenna as vice chair, and Corman, Glenn Morey, and Dan Klein to serve on that committee as well. On government operations, we have asked Amanda Champion to continue as chair of that committee, Dan Klein as vice chair, Rich John, Mike Stigler, and Mike Lane on that committee. I want to note that Mike Lane will serve for 2 months until we get a new legislator to fill the seat that Anna Kellis, our new assemblywoman, vacated. The Health and Human Services Committee, we've asked Shauna Black to continue as chair of the committee, Henry Granison as vice chair, Amanda Champion, Dan Klein, Mike Sigler, and Dan Klein to serve on that committee. Dan Klein, like Mike Lane, serving for 2 months, until the new legislator is elected. And the Housing and Economic Development Committee, we have asked Martha Robertson to chair. We've asked Mike Sigler to continue as vice chair. And Corman, Henry Granison, and Shauna Black as members of the committee to help lead our economic recovery efforts. Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, we have asked Ann Corman to chair, Deborah Dawson as vice chair, Dan Klein, Amanda Champion, and Dave McKenna as committee members to help lead that committee. Public Safety Committee, we have asked Rich John to continue as chair of that committee, Glenn Morey as vice chair, Henry Granison, Shauna Black, and Dave McKenna as committee members to help continue to lead the work this committee is doing on public safety. For our special committees, our Downtown Facilities Committee, as we continue to work through considering a new facility for the seat of Tompkins County government and some of our employees, we've asked Dave McKenna to continue to chair that committee, Rich John as vice chair, Mike Lane, myself, Leslie McBean-Clairborn, and Deborah Dawson as committee members. And for the Tompkins Intergovernmental Relations Committee, Tiger, we've asked Martha Robertson to continue as chair, Mike Sigler as vice chair, Deborah Dawson, Henry Granison, and Mike Lane as committee members. Thank you all for agreeing to take on these responsibilities for 2021. Colleagues, as we go into 2021, I want to leave you with these words from former First Lady Michelle Obama in her address to the 2020 graduates across America. She said, "We cannot allow our hurt and our frustration to turn us against each other, to cancel somebody else's point of view if we don't agree with every last bit of their approach. That kind of thinking only divides us and distracts us from our higher calling. It is the gum in the wheel of progress. Let us go forward together. Thank you very much." Thank you. I will move on to the chair's appointments along with committee appointments. There are also appointments, liaison appointments for 2021 to the Ithaca Area Economic Development Board of Directors. For some people watching, formerly TCAD, Martha Robertson and Mike Sigler. To the Ithaca Area Economic Development Executive Committee, Jason Molina. To the Chamber of Commerce, Mike Sigler, Leslie McBean-Clairborn, alternate. To Kern Cooperative Extension Services, Amanda Champion and Shauna Black. The Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, which is a special committee of the legislature. It's a little different. Henry Granison will chair that committee. To the Ethics Advisory Board, Rich John will continue as chair this year. To the Ithaca Metropolitan Planning Organization Policy Committee, Mike Lane and Dan Klein as the alternate. Tompkins Center for History and Culture, Rich John as the liaison. The Municipal Electric and Gas Alliance, this is an appointment, a term that's ongoing until resignation is received or removed by the chair of the legislature. Katie Bergella, Director of Planning and Sustainability, will continue as the liaison. To the Cayuga Lake Watershed Intermunicipal Organization, Amanda Champion, Ann Corman as the alternate. Our special negotiating teams, we've asked these folks to continue. Corrections Union, Rich John and Ann Corman. Road Patrol Civil Division, Henry Granison and Mike Lane. CSEA Blue Collar, Shauna Black and Glenn Morey. CSEA White Collar, Shauna Black. So the Tompkins County Community College negotiations teams for faculty, Mike Lane. For PAA, Shauna Black. For adjunct, Glenn Morey, and for CSEA, Glenn Morey. Those are all the appointments I have. There are questions about IDA appointments and TCOG and some others. most of those go through committee. So I just want to make sure that people are aware before they come to a resolution comes from committee to the legislature. So the labor seat that we voted on for the IDA will go through the committee process at HED, and then we will take that up. All of these assignments, chairs appointments, and the standing committees will take effect as of February 1, 2021, so that folks have time to wrap up the committees they've been on, and if they're transitioning out, wrap up their liaison assignments. Thank you very much. Moving on, I see staff. So let's see what staff is waiting for, if you will indulge me quickly. Let's take the consent agenda, because I think there's some on consent agenda that folks are waiting for. Consent agenda items, resolutions, and appointments to be voted on as a group. Unless any member of the legislature requests that a resolution or appointment be instead included separately and individually as part of the business of standing or special committees. Advisory board appointments. We have to the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Leslyn McBean Clairborn, and to from Health and Human Services, to the Human Rights Commission, Peaches Gillette. Term expires December 31, 2023. To the resolutions, under Tiger Committee, Resolution A, urging New York State to establish a Blue Ribbon Commission to reimagine and redesign state local service delivery, ID 9848. Health and Human Services Committee, Resolution B, 2020 Tompkins County Office for the Aging Budget Adjustment for the State-Funded Unmet Needs Program, ID 9842. Under Government Operations Committee, Resolution C, Resolution to Update the Administrative Policy Manual, Policy 06-07, Procurement, ID 9841, and Resolution D, Refund of Taxes, Village of Lansing, 45.12-1-51.13/7, ID 9839. May I have someone move the consent agenda, please? Moved by Amanda Champion, seconded by Ann Corman. Vote on the consent agenda.
Henry Grandison. Oh, there's a hand. Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich Dunn?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
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 13 ayes, 0 noes.
That passes unanimously. Thank you. I see Nick. I suppose Nick is waiting for Resolution E. So I will ask Mike Sigler, Vice Chair of Housing and Economic Development Committee, to take that up.
Don't worry, sir. Let's see here. So, adoption of local law number A of 2021, a local law amending local law number 4 of 1989, Tompkins County Hotel Room Occupancy Tax Law, amending the exemptions in section 150-12 of the Tompkins County Code, ID 9496. Nick, take it away.
Pardon, you need a second. I'm listening. May I have a second, please? Seconded by Martha Robertson. Discussion. Sorry. Mike?
I was just going to say, if Nick wants to explain it real quick since he's here, and then we can.
That's fine.
That's fine.
Hi there. Yeah, thanks. So this is following up on our the presentation from last week. I'm sorry, last meeting 2 weeks ago, where we discussed changing the room tax law primarily to make the tax rate consistent across all of our lodging properties. Right now we have two tax rates. If you are in a property that's 11 or more rooms, the tax rate is 5%. If you're in a property that's 10 or fewer rooms, the tax rate is 3%. We've been looking at the data here and in consultation with STPB, see that this is, you know, no longer a needed subsidy to the smaller properties. We've seen a tremendous amount of growth in that part of the lodging market, primarily due to platforms like Airbnb, VRBO, where we're finding a lot of people want to stay in those kinds of places, and they're paying to do so. So this would really, you know, level the playing field for customers and for the people within they're supplying these properties for tourists. So that's basically the very brief version of it. If you have questions about this or how we arrived at this recommendation, I'd be happy to answer them. So.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Mike. Other discussion? Mike Lane.
Yeah, I want to thank Nick for all the work you've done on this and your presentation. You've given us a lot of thought. I'm not able to support this tonight. I continue to feel that this lower rate for the small businesses is probably a good thing. I think it's the wrong time to raise the taxes. I understand the need and the places we could put the extra revenue, which are good, and hopefully someday we can do that. But I was on the legislature when we decided to leave the 3% on the beds and breakfasts. At that time, there was no Airbnb then. And I still think that the rationale back then to try to encourage those businesses is still a good one. And so tonight I'm not going to be able to vote aye on this.
Thank you, Mike. Ann Corman, then Shauna Black.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will be voting for this perhaps I'm incorrect, but I believe that we are the only or one of the few counties that, in essence, gives a subsidy or this lower rate to this type of short-term housing. And so this was done, again, I believe, at a time when we were encouraging this type of housing, which I think we have over 500 short-term rentals that we know of, at least in the county. And so having heard from, for instance, the town of Ithaca, how this has become a big issue of people buying properties to do short-term rentals, and how now municipalities are looking at how to roll back and figure out how to limit this, I don't think this is I think this is fair. This is something that people staying at these short-term rentals would be paying. It's not a tax on the businesses or the homeowner. And I've traveled a lot. I've never looked at, you know, is it 1 or 2%, you know, higher the tax, and then I'd go stay in another town. Unless it was, I never have. I mean, if it was really exorbitant and I had heard that, but I choose a place to travel because I want to go there. So I will be voting for this. Thank you.
Thank you, Annie. Shauna Black.
Hi, thank you very much. I will not be supporting this. Speaking from someone who has done Airbnb, who had every single one of my reservations canceled last year because graduation was canceled, It was definitely damaging to myself and my family. And I know that our bed and breakfasts and our hotels are suffering right now. I don't think right now is the time to add an extra tax to people traveling to our county. So I will not be supporting it. Perhaps in a future time I would, but this year is just not a good year.
Okay. Thank you, Shauna. Deb Dawson, then Martha Robertson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, Shauna's right. Our hotel and tourism industries have been suffering, but it's because of COVID. I really feel, especially after watching the governor's presentation today, the state's going to put billions of dollars to reinvigorate the arts. And the way we support our arts here in Tompkins County is in no small part through the hotel taxes that are distributed through the STPB. If we want to continue to be a destination of choice, we need to support all of the things that STPB pays for. And I'd much rather add a 2% tax that's paid by outsiders who visit us rather than somehow or another be taxing our residents to support tourism. So I will be supporting this. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. Martha?
Thank you, Leslyn. I'd agree with Annie and Deborah. I'd also point out that, you know, we had a public hearing on this law back in September, and we didn't get a single person come speak for or against it. I don't think we got any public, you know, written comments either. Certainly if this were seen as a threat, I think we would have heard from the people. I know that Nick sent the survey that he did to CVB, to something called the Bed and Breakfast and Vacation Rentals of Greater Ithaca, plus the tourism newsletter that goes to more than 400 different people. I know in the past when we have talked about sort of regulating Airbnb or trying to get, I mean, as a number of years ago, when we wanted to get people to register, we got lots and lots of public comment. So I think that, I really think that, oh, and by the way, Nick told me that, I said, well, so is there any list of Airbnb hosts that we can send to? He said, well, Airbnb has a database, but they won't share with anybody. And that's, so there's no way we could have solicited any more directly than that. So I think this is what some people call a nothing burger, honestly. I think, again, it's a tax paid by outsiders. It's would be about estimated $200,000 revenue a year that we surely can use. And my understanding is, in fact, that the Airbnb or the short-term rental business has picked up more than the hotel business has picked up, you know, after the initial lockdown. I think that the short-term rentals have picked up. So I think this is something, a subsidy that had its time and place. The business has outgrown it, doesn't need that subsidy. And the revenues really have an important purpose that will help to build the future Airbnb business. The more we, you know, can invest in outdoor recreation and other STPB priorities, the better. So I think this is a great move that isn't going to hurt Tompkins County residents, only going to help us. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Martha. Henry and then Dan Klein.
Yes. Thank you, Nick, for your presentation. Can you tell me about the results from the survey in terms of the numbers of responses and what the people also had to say about the tax?
Sure. Let me just pull up my file on that. You know, we had about 26 responses, if my memory is correct. And bear with me here as I navigate my computer to find this. Nope.
Okay.
Uh, pulling it up. So yeah, so the survey, you know, most of the responses, the vast majority were people who owned and operated a single establishment with three or fewer rooms. So a lot of these were, you know, homes that had been converted to serve as a lodging. The vast majority were founded after 2010, so they're relatively new businesses. Nearly 70% of them use Airbnb as a way to promote their establishment and book nights. Next up was VRBO or other short-term rental platforms, and then other types of advertising were listed and less popular. We had responses from, it looks like, 6 towns in the city of Ithaca, so a good representation, at least geographically, if not in terms of numbers. The vast majority, I'd say, you know, it was a mix of people, of lodging establishments. Some of them were renting out a part of their home. Others were renting out entire houses or apartments separate from their home. So a real mix of types of establishments. We saw about half of the respondents indicated that they were earning under 25% of their household income from the short-term rental. We had several questions focused on the uses of room tax that we asked the people. And by and large, you know, just to really summarize it here, you know, half or more of the respondents generally found that those were important uses of funding. So we saw that was something that the existing lodging industry is taking advantage of and finding value in. We asked how often do guests comment on the local room tax? About half of them said rarely or never. We had a sort of mixed results when we asked about, you know, if they believed that a 5% room tax would be appropriate for their lodging establishment, you know, more on the no side than yes. We had a mix of results for when we asked about if we believed guests would be willing to pay the additional room tax, about 50% saying no to one degree and about, you know, 30% saying yes to one degree or another. We had a, you know, just a split sort of decision on whether the host believed that an increased tax would cause visitors to change their travel plans, roughly a quarter saying no and roughly, 30% saying yes. Similarly with whether or not an increase in the room tax would have an adverse impact on their business, we saw that roughly, 20% saying that it would not, and roughly 40 or 50% saying that it would. Sort of a mix of results on whether the use of room tax funding would be worth the costs. We had approximately half saying no and approximately 28% saying yes. Which is actually disagreeing with earlier statements that many of them agreed with. So some things that need to be shaken out there. And then the overall question of whether or not they would support the tax. Unsurprisingly, I think we had about half, 54% of the respondents saying no, they would not support it. About a third, 31% saying they weren't sure, and 15% saying that they would support it. So, at the end of the day, I think, you know, nobody's surprised that, you know, we asked people if they want to pay it, you know, they want to have another tax higher. They said they don't want it. I think, you know, but when you kind of drill into it and look at, you know, where are they getting value out of the programs that we're delivering through this? I think that is accurate. And I think it also, you know, importantly, you know, the reason we're proposing this is because this can level the playing field for, the industry so that everybody is on the same page when it comes to the tax rate. So that's the results of the survey.
Okay, thank you. I will also not be supporting this due to the fact that what the survey results say, also the fact that I don't think taxes should be raised at this time. And in addition, thirdly, you know, the city has also got an authority to do a hotel occupancy tax. So for the city Airbnbs, there'll be additional tax they'll have to pay. And so I can't support this. Thank you.
All right, Deborah, you have the last word on this, and then let's take it. Oh, sorry. I had Dan. Sorry, I had Dan.
My huh?
Yes, your turn.
Thank you. I'm going to vote against this. I want to mention a few things about some of the language that's being used. It's kind of interesting. Subsidy. Two different people mentioned subsidy. This is not a subsidy. Subsidy is when somebody else pays for, you know, something that you're getting. This is, we're going to be raising a tax on them. We're not we never took a tax away from them. So that's not really a proper way to think about it. Talk about outsiders paying. Yes, I understand the concept behind that. I'll tell you, I live in a very small house. When my family from out of town comes to visit, they stay in Airbnbs. So, you know, my family are the outsiders in that case. Talk about leveling the playing field. I don't think it can ever be leveled. You have Marriott and Hilton on one side and literally mom and pop businesses on the other. I mean, I don't want it leveled. I want mom and pop businesses to get a little boost if we can do that. And then I just want to say, if the goal is more money for the arts and culture, I've been talking about this for a long time. I have lots of ideas. Please come to me, and I will tell you different ways that we can get more money to the arts and culture without raising tax on Airbnbs. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. All right, Deb Dawson and then Mike Stigler, I'll give you the last word.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm curious to know how many – you said, Nick, that you got 26 responses. How many requests did you send out?
I mean, we shared the survey with everybody on our list through Visit Ithaca and the tourism program email. The Visit Ithaca list is probably more relevant. That includes all of the registered operators that are registered with the county. It's over 100 different establishments. So that's that. And then as we mentioned earlier, you know, we're very, you know, we're aware that there's over, I think 900 to 1,000, you know, short-term rentals operating in the county any given time.
Yeah. I would submit for everyone's consideration that 26 responses really is not going to give you, a very good idea of where everybody stands on this. And it's also a self-selecting sample. No, because nobody's going to write in so that they can tell you that they think a tax is a great idea. They're going to write in to object. So.
Also tell me that the tourism newsletter goes to 400 or so people in addition.
That's correct. I don't know how many of those people are owners or operators of short-term rentals.
All right. Mike Sigler, you get to wrap it.
See what I can. I actually didn't think this was going to be opposed by this many people, to be honest with you. Mostly because it just brings in line with other rental units that are being rented as hotels. That's the part I guess. I'm going to tell you a quick story. In California, staying there in Venice Beach, I'm at an Airbnb. I wake up, you know, I smell smoke. I go into the bathroom and sure enough, the plug is smoldering. And, I'm thinking to myself, why hasn't a smoke detector gone off in this building? It's because there was no smoke alarm in the building. And so knowledgeable as I was, I shut the power off to that section of the building. And in the morning, the woman was very nice and she had the electrician go off. And I said to her, do you have a smoke alarm in your house? And she's like, no. And I'm like, put a smoke alarm in your house, for goodness sakes. So anyway, I'm just saying that, listen, hotels have a lot of costs, and there's a reason, because we inspect them and we do a lot of things. Airbnbs, while many a tight ship, many more don't. not that this is neither here nor there for this, but it's not like, well, Marriott, they've got a lot of money. Yeah, I guess they also have a lot of costs. So it's not like, hey, Marriott can afford to pay for it. And let's face facts. Airbnbs are eating up a lot of your rentals in the city of Ithaca. They just are. I mean, I know of at least two rentals. So that's, you know, not a good sample, but it's bigger. And they're eating up a lot of your rentals, and there's a reason rents are high, and that's why it is. So, listen, this is an established business. I rent Airbnbs all the time. This is literally where we stay. We don't stay in the Marriott. My family stays at an Airbnb because we get a kitchen. And you don't have to worry about, frankly, Airbnbs are more popular now than the hotels because you don't have to see anybody with COVID. You can just go to your house, presumably, and not see a soul. So it seems to me that it's time. This is a mature business. This is no longer, yes, it's a mom and pop, but you're being run through a very big organization. So anyway, that's my 2 cents on it. So thanks.
Well, thank you for your 2 cents, Michael. Thank you for wrapping up the discussion. Let's take this to a vote.
Henry Granison?
No.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
No.
Ann Corman?
Yeah, yes.
Mike Lane?
No.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
No.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslyn McBean Claiborne?
No.
Eight ayes, five noes.
That carries. Thank you very much. Thank you, Nick, for joining us. New tax. All right. Any other staff waiting for anything else? Nope. I think we've got everybody. Let's go back to our regular agenda. Reports by County Administrator, County Attorney, and Director of Finance. County Administrator, are you ready? Let's see, what time is it? Yeah.
Yes, I am, Leslyn. Thank you. We have our regular update on COVID, and I'll share my screen with everyone. Everyone see that?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. So this is the format we've used to give updates. Given them every legislative meeting since the beginning of COVID. Frank and Amy and Dominic and Jay are in the EOC, so they'll be able to answer any questions you have. Related to some of these issues, as well as myself. Just a little recap since January 6th, the last time we gave this presentation at the last LEDGE meeting. As you can see, cases are strong, so to speak. Community disease surveillance still continues to be a priority for us now, along with vaccinations. And Frank will talk a little bit more about vaccinations. Last time we met, we've had over almost 500 cases, since then, and unfortunately, 3 deaths. Executive orders continue to come in volume. As you can see, we've hit the 90 mark on executive orders, and most of these are extensions of existing executive orders. Nonetheless, they come out. The past 2 weeks have been fast and furious. There's been a lot of changes on the fly. The state has changed its approach to vaccinations. We've been getting information very quickly without much forewarning as we've tried to work in partnership with CHS to get the vaccination site up and running, which has been very successful, which is great to see. And our region has been spoken to and spoken about by our state representatives and NYSAC as being a leader and a model for folks to follow in terms of best practices. As you can see, we've had a continuation of discussions. We continue to also look at barriers to vaccinations. And when more supply comes in, which is the premier problem right now, and we'll talk more about it, is the lack of supply of vaccine. And as more vaccine becomes available, we will be able to distribute it in different ways. But at this time, just getting vaccine is a challenge. A lot of different public announcements, press releases around it, still continuing with exposures, to continue to do PSAs. Thank you, Leslin, for doing one 2 weeks ago. And we continue to push out now different education pieces regarding COVID response, isolation, quarantine, vaccinations with in different languages to reach out different members of our community, subgroups of our community. This is a slide you've seen before, again, kind of summarizing our expenditures. As you can see, well over $2 million worth of staff time dedicated to this. Continue to see use of FFCRA. This is the Expanded Family Medical Leave Act. This was extended with the latest stimulus package. It was not mandatory, although we continued it for that period of time, which will go to the end of March. This is leave for folks, either paid leave for folks or leave, extended family medical leave for folks that have to take care of dependents. It's been an important piece of the benefits we've offered our employees, so we continued it through to the end of March, which is the length of this stimulus package that we have. And also related expenses continue to grow, obviously, with the response, over $1.7 million, most of which, all of these expenses, will not be reimbursed. Here is community sponsor or our county sponsored health community testing. Obviously, we've been doing this now since September, so we took out the first, September through December 31st statistics, as you've seen in the past. This is the last few weeks of it, and the average per week numbers include all, since we've been doing it since the beginning of September. Just as a note, when we started in September, our weekly cost was around $8,000. As you can see, that's jumped quite a bit just due to the increased usage of the free testing that we've provided our residents, which is critically important. Here is just a schedule of what we've submitted to FEMA for reimbursement. It's not exactly to date to this date because there's always a lag of, particularly when it comes to the COVID testing, we have to get a bill, we have to pay the bill, we have to see that the check has been cashed, we have to get a copy of that cash check, and then we submit the reimbursement. So there are ones that are in the works right now, but as you can see, this is the only one that's not testing related, and those expenses were submitted on December 16th. These are eligible expenses, primarily PPE and food. Related to departmental and EOC eligible expenses. There's other supplies and materials in there, but this was submitted in December, and we're pending on still approval for that. You can see we did receive our first series of reimbursement from an October submission, which would have been the first few weeks of September and so on and so forth. So we're starting to see reimbursement come in, and we'll see how the next few weeks go to see if we get the additional reimbursement from these later submissions. But this is a good sign that we're starting to see reimbursement come in. Obviously, a lot more to come. And as you can see, increased testing that's happened over the past few weeks, we'll continue to submit those applications into FEMA. And if it changes in terms of another stimulus package that's been talked about by the president-elect, if that passes and there's an increase of reimbursement to 100%, we will obviously continue to submit for 100%, and at that point, we'll want to know and we'll try to investigate whether or not we can submit for any of these prior expenses that were only reimbursed at 75%. That'll be a point of the legislation we'll look for as we watch this and see how it goes through Congress. Before Frank gets into vaccine distribution, I don't know if there are any questions on anything I've covered so far. It's the standard reporting we've done for the past 2 weeks. I think the next month, for the next meeting, we'll talk about the demographics, as we usually do that every other or once a month or every other legislative session.
Yeah, Jason,
I can't see you, so if you have a question, you might have to shout it out.
Okay, shouting here. Hi, Jason. Could you On the FEMA reimbursement, I did talk to Amanda Spellacy, and she said there is an agreement between Biden and Schumer that they're going to get the 100%, but she said it will go to the states, the 12.5%, and so that's kind of up to the states how they distribute it.
Yes, that's what we've heard too.
Okay. And I wasn't sure about retroactive. Could you go back? The Health Equity Task Force, I don't remember seeing anything about that before. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. So the state has created these vaccination hubs, and part of that they wanted to appoint members from different communities to address equity issues. So we have several members from our community that were appointed to the task force, the Equity Task Force. We met today briefly with them, and Fami's on the line. I don't remember all the names of the individuals that were appointed by the state to that equity task force, and this is span across the whole region. They kind of get the sense the region is still trying to figure out how to approach what the task force, what the equity task force responsibilities are, but our conversation included, you know, them to continue to talk to their colleagues across the region, communicate to us as well as act as a resource with us about equity issues that they may come across with different subgroups and populations they work with in our community.
So you mean they're sort of tackling underrepresented groups and trying to get to people who might not otherwise have access to the vaccine? Is that the idea?
Loosely right now, like I said, there isn't really great guidance or structure as to what the task force is supposed to be doing. So we, you know, like compliments to Amy and Frank for setting up the meeting with representatives from our region. And, you know, and we basically said, you know, we're going to look to you to bring forward, you know, bring concerns and issues to us so we can help address them as we come across, you know, future barriers and so on and so forth. So, they openly acknowledged, the structure of the task force is not very strong right now, so they're trying to understand what the purpose of it is.
Okay, well, it sounds like a really important thing, and I hope it develops, especially when we're all competing for non-existent doses. While it's really non-existent, then I guess there's no point, but there's a lot of education to do. And I'm interested in the Spanish language. Are we able to get, I dare say, anybody at the national level producing those kind of materials? It seems like the least government could do.
But I'll let Dom, because he's been working on it, but I don't think there's anything that we've come across. This is all stuff we created, right, Dom?
The Spanish video that we put out was translated by a community volunteer, and we do have a section of the FAQs that's been translated as well, or that we worked, we got a translation of a short and a long version. I believe the one is linked right at the top of our FAQs currently, and the other longer version we just got in today, so that'll go up as well. And we are doing the same for other vaccination pieces too.
Well, thank you very much for doing that. It makes me crazy that we have to create that locally when somebody at the state level or federal level isn't handing that stuff out. So thanks very much for doing it. Thank you.
Henry, do you have a question?
Yeah, I just have a quick question. The Executive Order 20289 election changes, which changes were those?
I don't know, but I might guess it would be around village elections.
Okay.
Yeah, that's probably the next group. Jay, I don't know if Jay's there. We can find out more information about it. Yes, we did.
Okay, thanks.
For sure.
Anyone else before Frank? Anybody else? Okay, go ahead.
Great, thanks, Leslin. You actually did a pretty good job of covering most of it in your state of the county, so we appreciate that. Again, thanks to our partnership with Cayuga Health Systems, we've been able to stand up a large-scale vaccination site here in the county. You'll see that we've combined between them and what they've done in the hospital and what we've partnered with them, they've done over 7,000 vaccines to date. And so that's a big number. We did almost 5,000 in the last 2 weeks at the mall site. And so that is nothing short of a success as far as our region and what other places have been able to do. And quite frankly, we got the volume of vaccine that we did because we were early and we were persistent that we could do it and that we would stand it up quickly and vaccine would get into arms and that we could demonstrate that. And thankfully, they gave us vaccine so we could prove it, and that subsequently resulted in an additional large allocation last week. Unfortunately, we did not get any vaccine this week. It's unfortunate. We would love to be vaccinating people this week as well, but as everyone has seen, the state has begun standing up their large-scale mass vaccination sites. There's one in Binghamton and one in Syracuse. The state has gotten the same amount of vaccine this week as they did last week from the federal government, and they didn't have those large sites last week. So the vaccine has to come from somewhere in order to make those sites work. And so we didn't receive vaccine this week. The counties around us got very small amounts, 100 doses, 200 doses. You may have seen the announcement about the large-scale site at SUNY Cortland. Cortland got 200 doses this week. Everyone is dealing with the shortage. We do expect that we will get vaccine next week. We don't know how much we'll get, but we are planning and ready to accept whatever doses they can give us. And as Jason and Leslin have both pointed out, we have gotten the attention of the state that if they give us vaccine in large amounts, it will go into arms quickly and will not sit on shelves. So we're hopeful that that bodes well for us for the future. We do have the one site at the mall. Cuyahoga Health Systems has a relationship with the mall with the testing site. And so it was a really fortuitous for all of us that we were able to repurpose the old Sears building up there. It's a big, giant open space, which really is conducive for setting up the large-scale type operation that we've had to do. The reason for one large-scale site versus doing multiple small-scale is the efficiency that it creates for us. As I've said, we got large amounts of vaccine because we were able to prove that we could get it into people very quickly. And the only way to do that quickly is through those efficiencies that are created at a large-scale site. We do fully expect that at some point when vaccine supply becomes more readily available, we will be doing smaller pods throughout the county using our medical countermeasures plan that we already have in place with the agreements that we have with local school districts and other entities that have spaces we could use. And, of course, we're looking forward to hearing from the Health Equity Task Force on ideas and connections that we can make to ensure everyone in Tompkins County has access. But at this point, the supply, the limited supply, really dictates that we are as efficient as possible using the one large-scale site. And if you haven't noticed, the state site is essentially, the large state sites are essentially a mirror of what we've been doing at the mall. It's not as if we're doing something different. We did it first in this instance. Certainly as we get more information about vaccine, we'll continue to communicate it out. When we found out we weren't getting any vaccine this week, Dominic and the PIO team put out a release, did phone the robocalls to let folks know. Because the one thing we don't want is people just sitting around waiting, clicking on the website over and over. And we'll show you what that looks like in a minute on our next slide. We have been working with 211 to get them prepped to be able to help answer questions. The one thing they're not going to be able to do right now is register people. We are using the web-based application from the state, and as we've seen, those appointments fill up almost immediately. The 1,800 doses we launched last week were filled in 20 minutes. I was surprised and amazed, didn't even know that was possible, but folks figured it out and made it happen. So to call 211 when we announce to get help to register, by the time they were able to get through the information you need, the slots would be gone. So we understand that not everyone has the internet. And that's a barrier that we have to overcome. But in these initial phases, as we're trying to get as much vaccine to a very large group of currently eligible people, it is the mechanism that the state has put in place for us to be able to accomplish that. We will continue to work to try to make everyone have access to the vaccine as we continue forward. But again, the efficiency of our operations at this moment limits the ability for us to expand those opportunities. You can go to the next one, Jason. So this is what we were referring to. So this references the health department page views per day. There was probably a decade where we didn't have 38,000 hits on our webpage, and we had it in one day, right? And folks are clicking and clicking and clicking to get access to those appointments on our website. So we do know that folks are accessing it and are able to use that as a mechanism. We don't yet have demographic data of the folks that have been tested. We will, of course, work on that to be able to provide that the same way for vaccinations, the same way we have for testing. I can tell you anecdotally, having been there for 7 of the 8 days that the mall was open, it is a wide swath of people. There's many seniors that are managing to navigate the web or have family members that are doing it for them. We've seen teachers, law enforcement, frontline grocery workers. So we are seeing a cross mix of individuals getting through. Obviously, we don't have enough vaccine for everyone that's currently eligible. And until we do, and it's our goal, our strategy is to prove to the state that we can do as much as possible in as little time as possible, so they see us as a primary source to provide vaccine to, which will has to date, up until this week, granted us access to more vaccine than anyone else in our region each week. So that's been our strategy and how we're going to continue, at least for the next few weeks, until we see how the vaccine supply stabilizes. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank. I just want to add one thing. We did issue a contract with 211 to provide them with resources to be able to staff up that. So it's about a $60,000 contract that that I authorized so they can man that, and so they can add more staff to that. To help support that effort. That was unexpected, but necessary in order for them to be able to take calls in and eventually assist with folks. We are also seeing if FEMA can reimburse that through the effort.
Yeah, Jason, one other thing to offer, because we've gotten a lot of questions about scheduling out into the future like the state sites do. The reason they can do that is they control the supply chain. So they can divert whatever vaccine comes to the state to ensure that they have enough for their sites, and then the rest of us gets what's left of the state's allocation. So we don't know week from week what we're going to get. They can be assured they're going to get X amount of vaccine because they control the supply. And in fact, yesterday we received guidance from the state that prohibits us from booking out until we have vaccine in hand. The only sites that are allowed to do that are the state sites and the pharmacies, because they have promised to the pharmacies a consistent allocation each week of very small amounts of doses, roughly about 100 doses per pharmacy.
And Frank, just to clarify, the pharmacies have priority for the 65 plus population, correct?
Correct, they do. Yep.
Yep.
But doesn't that just guarantee that we're going to be getting a trickle of vaccine doses, as long as the state can schedule out in advance and we can't? I mean, I get complaints all the time now from constituents and friends who say, why can my friends in Appalachian and schedule an appointment in Tioga County? Now, why can't we do that here in Tompkins County? I mean, you can't expect everybody's going to run down to Binghamton to get a shot.
I think, Deborah, as long as the supply is limited, this is an issue. When supply opens up, and it will become less of an issue because, you know, the state sites, right now our site has been able to do more vaccinations daily than they have. And I think that's going to continue to be the issue until more supply is distributed across the state.
And God knows when that will be.
That's hopefully that's short-lived, you know, and what's been happening is, you know, last week's new news is old news by the next day, and hopefully by next week this is old news and we'll be in a much different position. But the supply is the primary issue that's constrained everything from you know, the ability to vaccinate more people. Once that starts to loosen up, then the conversation changes a little bit.
I have a question from Mike Dean.
Yeah, I don't think I've had questions on COVID as much about any part of it except trying to get these shots scheduled. I simply cannot understand why we can't have a database. You're saying now that the state won't let us, that can schedule people with the understanding that they'll only be reached if we have the vaccine available, and some way that they could be called back and said, you're on the list, but you're not, we don't have vaccine. The problem is that we're getting is these people can't even get on the list. And that's what's making people mad. That's why you got 38,000 people on our website coming in, because they have no hope of getting on a list anywhere, whether the vaccine's available or not. So I think there's a problem here. We've had, what, 6-8 months to be thinking about this. And I'm not saying just Tompkins County, but nationally. I can't imagine that they didn't think about people wanting to get this, get these shots and not even be able to schedule anywhere, so that they could, have a hope of getting them. And if I, one other question I have, if I could please, is, are all our nursing home residents now vaccinated?
My understanding is the state program, the federal program that the state opted into, completed all nursing homes in New York on Sunday. That's the last that I heard the governor announce that. Unfortunately, we're not in that loop of the nursing homes because it was done at the state and federal level. I have not heard from any of our local nursing homes that they have not been visited. And they will be getting a second visit, obviously, for the second dose and to catch people that weren't caught the first time. And then they go a third time to give the second dose to any of those people they caught the second time. So it is an ongoing program. And my understanding is that all of the nursing homes in New York were hit with their first visit as of last Sunday. So 2 days ago.
Thanks.
All right, Anne and then Martha.
Thank you. So a question I had as far as it sounds like to me, so please correct me, it's kind of a question. I'll get to a question, but please correct me in the meantime. So is it Cayuga Medical Center that is totally in charge of the site at the mall right now and as far as vaccinations, and then Who's governing or who's managing the sign up? Is that partly through us, or are we only providing a link to it? So just wondering who's managing the sign up.
Sure. So I would characterize what's happening in the mall as a partnership between the county and the hospital. We had staff there. I was there supporting the leadership team, and they have staff there, and they've secured the site. They are managing the vaccine with their pharmacy staff. To your question about registration, we are using a state system called CDMS, Countermeasure Data Management System. It's been around for a long time. We've used it for pods for a very long time. Never imagined doing everyone in the state in a few months' time, so it's a bit overwhelmed, which is why some of the crashing is occurring, particularly for registration. But the state initially required CDMS as the appointmenting system. So the hospital, they created a CDMS Lite for hospitals for the early phases. The health departments have a more robust version, which includes a direct upload to the state, New York State Immunization Information System, or NICIS. And so because that is a direct link without any additional steps, we are using the health department's version of CDMS to do registration. So I sit with the leadership team at the hospital. We determine what days vaccination clinic is going to be open, how many slots we're going to have, how many slots per 5 minutes we create. We create it in our CDMS and launch it live from there. And then those links that it creates are what are put on our website for people to register with.
Okay, now I'm a little bit more confused. So I don't need to know all maybe other people do, the type of system, but so we're using, a state sign up registration system. And then did you just say that CMC also has a different type of system, or is it all one sign up system?
So right now we're just using one sign up system. It's the health department's version of the data system I referenced.
The state health department.
Yes, and right. Well, it's the state's system, but the local health department has a version of it that we are using for registration.
Right, we didn't make it up ourselves. Okay, correct. So this helps me to answer some of the questions we're getting.
Danny, it's the same system. It's the same system they're using for the state sites. Right?
Okay,
it's the very same system.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay, Martha, and then Henry.
This is going to be so hard, and you know, our residents are just going to get worn out with this. And I don't know if there's any, you know, can we hire some more project assistants to call people? I keep saying, if you can come up with another solution or an add-on, I know people are really, really frustrated out there. So, And I think that adds to COVID fatigue. I think it adds to people's frustration with continuing to mask and socially distant, you know, stay distant and all that stuff. So I just reiterate that. Which vaccine are we getting? Is it always one or the other?
Yeah, everything we've done at the mall so far has been the Moderna vaccine.
Okay. All right. Well, just keep hanging in there. And really, if you can come up with any creative ideas to lessen the pain that need money, just come and ask. Thanks.
Martha Husby, ready to spend money. Get creative, Jason and Frank.
It's because I'm on it again.
I understand, Martha. I'm picking on you. I understand. Henry.
Yes. I have a couple of questions about the first and second vaccines. But first of all, what impact did the announcement on Friday that the federal government had in fact distributed all their vaccines out of reserves have on the general, the vaccines that you have are able to get?
Sure. So when doses come, they are earmarked either first dose or second dose. We don't have any first doses in the county right now. Last Friday, we administered the last ones we had. There are second doses, so they have been coming as expected on the schedule for when the second dose is up. Particularly for the hospital workers that were the very first ones to get vaccinated. They've already begun their second dose clinics at the hospital. So we do have some folks in the county that have gotten their second dose. Now all of that happened before this most recent change in announcement. Everything and all we can do is rely on what we're told. The state has told us we don't need to worry about second doses, that they will come and they will be shipped to us. And to date, that has been true. We're hopeful that the folks at the federal level understand the production capabilities of the manufacturers and are accounting for that as they're developing their plan moving forward. So right now, we're getting the second doses as expected, and we're hopeful that that will continue.
Okay, so when people get the first dose, I heard they're given a card showing they're scheduled for their second dose.
Correct. We don't want people to leave their first dose without having their second dose appointment. Now, the system did go down quite a bit last week. And so when the system's down, obviously you can't register for your second dose, but we do let people leave with a QR code and a website to go to do it later. And we're working with CMC to do a reconciliation process to make sure that anyone that got a first dose is reminded that their second dose is coming up and that they have an appointment for that second dose.
Okay, so how many second doses have been delivered in the Tompkins County so far?
I don't know that number yet. It's all that's all hospital workers at this point. So we're working with the hospital to get a reporting process in place so we can report both first and second dose administration in the county. We're probably going to need a few more days before we're at a place where we're ready to report that, but we do plan to report it.
I also saw that the state put up a vaccine tracker website tracking it by regions. Will you guys be doing a similar website tracking it by day for the county?
Yeah, we're still efforting what it'll look like, but it is our intention to give as much real-time data on vaccines as possible. We're just trying to figure out what reporting mechanisms we can use to reliably give us those numbers on a regular basis.
Okay, thank you.
All righty. Got all your vaccine questions out? You know, the state tried to buy directly from Pfizer, but they were not allowed to. They were refused. So we'll keep waiting to get supplies. Thank you all very much. Thank you, Frank. Thank you, Jason. Jason, is there anything else from you before we take a break? Henry, do you have your hand up again?
Yeah, I was wondering whether Jason can talk about the governor's budget.
Sure, I can try to.
We're supposed to get 5% back.
Well, I'll give you a quick overview from what I took away from it, and I'm sure Martha, Deborah, and some other folks are watching it. The governor's presentation on the budget really didn't add anything, as far as I'm concerned, to what the budget was going to look like. It was more waging war against the federal government and what they need in terms of reimbursement. That's my recap of it, my uneditorialized recap. The second part of it was by Budget Director Mojica. He gave a very high-level review, kind of talked about how the original projections aren't as bad but are still bad, and that they need, you know, their budget is put together with an expectation of at least $6 billion in relief. But if they got $15 billion, which is what they should get, it will prevent the reductions that are putting forth in the budget, around a 5% across the board cut, some other cuts in other areas. He broadly talked about some COVID recovery investment, some words around $150 billion or something on that line, split up between some small business funds, arts and culture areas, theater, and there were some specific numbers, but I don't know exactly what they were in detail, and then also in an infrastructure investment. That said, I did speak with Ryan Gregoire from NYSAC today. He's in the process right now of getting the budget bill. So I would expect by Friday at the latest, we'll have NYSAC's interim report, and we'll send it out to everybody to take a look at. So for some good reading this weekend, and probably by mid next week, be able to give you a little better analysis of it. Ryan's initial take on it was it isn't as bad as it could be, but there are still some, you know, some stumbling blocks in it, but, that's about all I got out of it so far, because he's reviewing it right now.
So. And Jason, that 5% across the board potential, 5% across the board includes cuts to aids to municipalities, and as opposed to what we were thinking, 20% threatened earlier?
Right now it looks to be closer to 5%. I'm going to guess that there is some inconsistencies, and that 5 across the board is just a generalization. There are probably some a little bit more, some a little bit less. So, you know, but generally it didn't seem to be touching on 20%. It seemed to be lower than that. But that does take into account consideration that they would get $6 billion in aid. So obviously if they don't get $6 billion in aid, it could be worse.
All right, Martha, you got a minute before we take break.
So, Jason, I was confused about that because they've been withholding 20%. Does that mean – they're going to release 15% back?
That's what I would hope, yes. That's the way math might work in my head. But when and if they're two different, you know, are different things. But that's my take out of it, yeah. That was one I had to find, but he didn't have an answer for that one.
Okay. All right. And Mojica's presentation was obviously a ton more actual information. This $300 billion infrastructure, you know, plan is still in place, and that's a lot of stuff. Though maybe not so much for the southern tier, but that was a mix of tax increases and federal money and debt. And he also mentioned the FMAP increase. If people remember that there was the first COVID bill, there was increased Medicaid that went to the states and to the localities, to the counties, only through March 31st, and Mojica expects Biden to extend that emergency declaration or whatever, you know, with it, so that he expects that'll be extended. I don't know, 6 months or longer, but so that was good news.
And they're counting on that too.
Yeah, they are. I it'll probably be extended. The question is what happens into 22.
Yeah. Okay.
The only thing I wanted to add, Leslin, and I know Frank and Amy and Dom are there, I just want to speak to the challenges that they have faced over the past 2 weeks in setting up this operation in partnership with CHS. I had the fortunate experience of viewing and taking a quick tour of the site. It's nothing short of remarkable. To Mike Lane's point, the vaccines we knew were coming for 6 months, and just the constant change of information that was coming from the state or lack thereof, and the ability for this partnership to set up an operation like it did, vaccinate as many folks as it did, the state, and they're very appreciative of the effort and recognizing it. We understand we didn't get vaccine, but I have, if we continue on this track and continue the good track record, we're going to continue to increase the amount of folks we'll be able to vaccinate on a weekly basis. So I just want to compliment Frank, Amy, Dom, the whole team and the EOC and the partnership with CHS, particularly Dr. Sloan and his team. They've really, it was a heavy lift to do what they did with testing, which is taking off and done extremely well as a model. And they did it again with the vaccinations. And I think it's just something that deserves its recognition because it's really been remarkable. When you're seeing major areas, urban areas like Onondaga County with almost 500,000 population vaccinating 10,000 people, when a population of 100,000 like us is vaccinating over 7,000. Those are some pretty interesting comparatives when you think about it. So
yeah.
They've done a remarkable job. I just want to make sure everybody understands the order of magnitude. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for that. And just as a quick heads up, my agent will be contacting you all for all those PSAs. I think it's FEMA reimbursed, just letting you know. Thank you. Let's take a break. Let's be back here at 8 o'clock and bang through the rest of our agenda. Meeting resuming. Back to our reports. County Attorney Jonathan Wood.
Hey, I'm actually going to give a report. I'm going to give a report on something I never give a report on. And that is, as you all probably know, one of the major functions of the county attorney's office is family court, juvenile delinquency, and persons in need of supervision.
Can you speak up a little bit more?
Sure. Juvenile delinquencies and PINs, and as you probably know, almost everything that happens in those courts are confidential. Are people hearing me okay?
Yes.
Okay. Much better. Thank you.
Sure. Sorry. But there are a couple of things which happened in the past week, which I think are worth reporting on. So I'll do that. Number one, you all may recall almost exactly 2 years ago, there was a stabbing in downtown Ithaca, which involved three youths, one 13 years old, one 15, and one 16. Happened pretty near our office. We thought it might be a murder at first. The person was in critical condition, but fortunately, the victim lived. And the three youths were prosecuted by our office, and it was reported in the paper they were prosecuted for gang assault and assault. I wanted to kind of follow up on what's happened since then. as a result of this, it was discovered that one of the three perpetrators, the 13-year-old actually, was wanted for murder in another state. After the proceedings finished in our court, the other state came to pick him up, and he was charged with murder and convicted there. And just the other day, we received a press release from another state indicating that because of the exceptional circumstances involved with this youth, including while he was sought for a murder in the other state, he committed close to a murder in Ithaca. But in any event, I think yesterday or the day before, he was sentenced to 63 years in jail. So, I mean, and he was sentenced on the murder in the other state, not on what he did here, but I imagine they accounted for what he did here. So that's one thing. Second issue is something that has come up periodically, which is an issue and happened again this past week. As you may know, periodically youths are picked up on warrants or having committed a crime. So this past week, a youth was picked up on a warrant and supposed to be placed in a residential facility, because it's over the weekend until the youth can appear in court. And what periodically happens and seems to be happening more is that there's no residential facility we could find to place the kid. And in this case, the kid ended up spending the night sleeping on the sheriff's floor. It's an unacceptable situation, but it tends to be recurring, and it's really something we need to do something about. It's a complicated situation, but, you know, these are children or youths who there's no place for them to go, and we can't find a bed for them under the rules and restrictions and the beds available, and we end up having no place to put them. And it's happened several times in the last recent years, including last week. Obviously, we're working on the situation, but just so you folks are aware of that. That's my report.
Thank you, Jonathan. I almost half want you to not give a report if that's the report you're going to hear, but good Lord. I hear you, but thank you, definitely. Mike Lean?
John, just following up on that, we've heard before about this problem not having a residential place for these young people. And I thought we were going to talk about having maybe a regional approach to this. Do we at Tompkins County, is it really falling on us to try to get this thing started?
Well, you know, I've talked with DSS, and this is, like I said, it's a complex problem. And they have tried, according to DSS, to get a regional facility where we can join up with some other counties to have a bed available. It's kind of complicated too, because there are various classifications on which, you know, so a place that's suitable for one youth may not be suitable for another youth. But the plain truth is we just haven't been successful at it.
I can add a little bit to this. Yeah. The issue particularly that they're talking about is beds around specialized secure detention, which was created Raise the Age legislation. And while we were actively involved with the multiple counties on the potential construction of a new facility in partnership with this kind of consortium, the state, I think, pretty much put the kibosh to it. And it's kind of just sit there lingering at this point without really much resolution. The challenge is that I don't think the increased numbers from the original pre-Raise the Age estimates have come through. So the state is not willing, from my understanding of this, and correct me if I'm wrong, John, that it wasn't willing to really put forward the capital to construct additional facilities. And what's happening is if there's an uptick in cases and there isn't a bed available across the state, there isn't a solution. Frankly, we've dealt with this, you know, less than a handful of times, but about that over since the Raise the Age has come into play. And the problem is the state isn't willing to free up beds or isn't willing to push facilities to free up beds that maybe being reserved by other counties or other agencies. And we're stuck, you know, holding folks for 24 hours or more at times without, proper facilities. It actually would probably be safer and more comfortable to actually provide them with a cell by themselves than actually doing what we're doing. But, right now that isn't a viable option. And it pokes its head every few months.
Yeah. So that's partly light. And what Jason says, that deals with secure. This one actually happened to be non-secure, which is different.
Oh, was it? Okay.
The issue occurs in both circumstances. Secure, actually, we tend to be doing a little better on. The problem is that they'll find a bed and it'll be someplace like down on Long Island or something. So the sheriff will end up driving 4.5 hours to pick the kid up, to drop the kid off, because that'll be the closest bed if we find one at all. It's a problem, what Jason says, and it's also a problem in other cases in non-secure.
All right, multiple hands. I'll go across the screen. Deborah, Martha, Rich.
Yeah, to follow up on Mike's question, I thought that we had entered into some kind of agreement with other counties to address this issue. And then, Jason, you said the state put the kibosh on it. How and why did they do that?
My understanding, and Deborah, I can get more information, but my understanding is that the expected or estimated increase in cases that would fit into this specialized secure detention facility was not at the levels that they thought it would be, so they did not approve the ability to move forward in constructing the facility. That's my understanding of it. I haven't had this conversation recently, but I can follow up more with Kit to get more detail on it.
So that I was going to jump in there and suggest that before we get dig too much deeper into here, that we probably want to check in with the folks at DSS, at HHS, and find out more about this, lest we start throwing our own information that we're not accurate on.
Okay. So, absolutely, Leslie. Like I say, it's a complex issue. It deals with the combination of state law, what facilities are available, what DSS could find, what's available to us. It's really not a simple question that can be solved, at a meeting.
All right, I'll take two more comments or questions, Martha and then Rich, and then let's move on.
Thanks, Leslie. Thank you, Jonathan, for this. We have to know somebody on the State Assembly Corrections Committee, somebody named Anna Kelly. So we might have an in there. I'm also vice chair of the Public Safety Committee of NYSAC. I mean, we should really kind of find out what other counties are running into with this. And then is this crazy? If we have a case like this again, what's the penalty if we let the young person sleep in a cell one night? What happens?
Well, I've asked that question. And again, this is a complex issue. There are methods in which you can get that waiver, but this is not a corrections issue, I should say. This is an OCFS issue.
All right.
So you're on a different jurisdiction, Martha. Sorry.
Okay.
But the answer is unknown, but it's a challenging question to ask. I'll leave it at that. This is a very complex issue because the first time it happened, we were dealing with an issue where no one wanted to retain custody of the individuals. So we were end up, and the clarity from the judge wasn't there either. So it was kind of like sitting in a kind of a limbo. So it's a complex matter that there isn't a great solution with right now, and the state isn't really providing much in terms of options.
I guess I would maybe propose asking for forgiveness as opposed to permission next time. And, so if they, say you did a bad thing, we sue them for not providing what they promised to provide.
Putting a youth in a cell, it definitely is an option, but it obviously elevates issues.
Yeah, it's better than the floor. Thank you.
Rich.
Yeah, I think most of what can be said on this has been said. I would echo that this is a well-intentioned policy that we really shouldn't want to have 16 and 17-year-olds in our jails. But the execution by the state has been horrendous, and it's been complicated by the pandemic. There is a fairly simple solution, which is to become more flexible in where you can hold these individuals, and the state just hasn't addressed it at all. I think this is a good topic to raise at public safety and to combine with the Tiger Committee to try to get some rationality out of the state.
I would also say health and human services.
Yes, it's really unfortunate.
Yeah. All right.
Sure.
Well, thank you, Jonathan. Any other fantastic news you want to share with us?
No, that's it.
Okay. Finance Director Rick Schneider. Rick, are you there? Oh, no. Fantastic news from you, too.
Got great news. Three things I'd like to go over with you pretty quick tonight. They're abbreviated reports, so it won't take a whole lot of time. I'm going to share my screen and show you what was sent out to you earlier, right before the meeting, around 5 o'clock today. And you should be looking at a report, are you?
Yes.
Yes, we are.
We got a very short sales tax report because I didn't have a chance to do the complete distribution because we just got them at the end of last week. But I do have a short little blurb, which brings us up to date for year end from Dave Lucas. This is from his report that was sent out last week. And even though I can't share with you December's numbers alone, I can show you our year to date, including December. And they're reporting right here that our total for 2020 was $50 million. Almost $51 million compared to 2019, which was $57 million. So the net change from year to year shows up right here where it says $5.9 million less than 2019. That works out to a decrease of 10.4% for the year. So you remember last month when we were looking at the end of November, we were showing that we were down for the year 12%. I think the month before that, we were around 14% deficit. So we now have figures that show we're down 10.4% for the whole year for sales tax, which hurts us by $5.9 million. I'll be sharing the rest of the December sales tax report either by email or at our next meeting. So are there any questions on sales tax? Okay, if not, I'll move on.
Hold on. Rick, Mike Lane has a question.
Rick, you had sent us out a table a couple of days ago, and so puts this 10% in perspective. We were the county with the
worst,
largest decline
right
upstate of all the counties. Well, is that right?
All counties.
The largest county in total, except for New York City, we were the largest deficit county as a percent. So,
not a great thing to be, but that's
the good news in this. I think we came in fairly close to some of our early estimates when COVID just began. You know, this is within that window, is it not, Jason? Pretty close to what our early estimates were?
I guess so, yeah.
I mean, that's unfortunate, you know, to say that we hit the estimate, but, you know, at one point in time, we were looking at maybe 15 or 16% down, and you know, this shows right here that once I put out the December reports, this 10.4% might go up or down a point or two, but nothing tremendous to change there. I do have the room tax report, which...
Hold on.
Go ahead.
Rick, I think Rich John has a question.
Thanks, Leslie. I would just note that 2019 was an absolute record. So there's a reason Tompkins County fell more than any other upstate county. It's because we were so much above them. You know, we've had the best economy in upstate. I think it's important to keep that in mind. And also that the fundamentals here remain, that when we get through the pandemic, we should be able to pick up the pieces and restart and get going again. These are bad numbers, but I think we have to be careful to keep them in context, that they're bad because we had such a great 2019. And we should be able to come back from some of that. And correct me if I'm wrong, Jason.
I think you're right in terms of foundation, but I don't want to sugarcoat it. It is the worst in the state by several percentage points, you know. So I think there are several things that come into play. Both are good in terms of elasticity. One is I'm fairly certain higher ed played a role in this, and that, you know, students not being here has impacted. Even in the fall, you had, you know, 75% in-person enrollment. So there's the sheer presence or lack of presence of students, I think, played a role in this, and hopefully next fall that will be different. So I think that will rebound as a result of it. Also, travel has not taken place, and travel doesn't take place. That is a component of our economy, both business travel, whether it's related to Cornell or higher ed or other things, and then leisure travel. Again, that's a big feeder into sales tax, and hopefully, again, if not this summer, towards the tail end of the summer and the fall, that will start to recover. To your point, the economy does have a good foundation, but you know, these are real numbers, and they are really the worst in the state. I just want to be serious about that. That's the real deal. No one lost ahead of us with this one. But I do think that we are better positioned to recover, because of some of the robustness of the economy, the local economy.
Well, thank you,
yeah,
Jason.
I certainly didn't want to undersell how bad it is. I just wanted the context around it. Yeah. Thanks.
Thank you, Rich, for trying to sprinkle a little sunshine on it. Thank you, Jason, for trying to pull the clouds back over it.
Sorry, Rich.
Go ahead, Rick.
Two other sectors that affect the sales taxes is the gas prices. So our gas sales were down a lot, plus the gas prices were down very, very much. So that had a big impact. And the other big sector that takes a hit is the hotel and tourism sector, where we have restaurants and hotels and anything leisure-oriented. We have had a tremendous negative impact for us this past year. In fact, that sector, hotels, leads us into the next report, which is the room tax report. And we really scurried to try to get this out early to you this month. In fact, we just got finalized numbers today. We had some preliminary numbers. I appreciate Lisa Schott and Nick Helmholt working together to put these numbers together for us. But here is the 2020 room tax. The fourth quarter came in at $146,000.
Hey, Rick, excuse me. Could you zoom in a little bit closer on that to see?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Right here.
You went back out.
Rick, you can go to the bottom right of your screen. You can quickly, there you go.
How's that?
Much better, thank you.
If we look at this figure here, the 145,794, that is extra money that came in due from late payments from previous quarters. So that number is pretty high compared to other years. That additional revenue is attributed to taxes collected outside of the fourth quarter. But the fourth quarter came in at 289,417 compared to 746,565. Also in the fourth quarter, you can see that the hotels were hurt more than the bed and breakfast. The hotels only came in at about a third of what they were last year, 218,000 compared to 677,000 in the fourth quarter. Bed and breakfast, though, actually came in higher in the fourth quarter at 71,000 compared to 69,000. So you can see where people are going. I think we discussed that pretty much tonight. Maybe you should have had these numbers before you voted, but never. You can see that the total down here for bed and breakfast at 244,000 is about two-thirds of the 357,000 they were at last year. But over here on the hotel side, 876,000 is about one-third of the 2,491,000 that they brought in last year. So, unfortunately, when you add it all up, that our room tax was down $1.7 million. That's these totals here again. Compared year over year, down 1.7 or 57.8% less than 2019. And there's a few remarks at the bottom there from our Treasury Division. It just tells how many were late, which ones were late in the third and the fourth quarter. It's always the same, 3 to 5 hotels. We still put out the letters to them when they are late. The next reminder letters or the last reminder letters just went out on January 14th. So we should get some response for those 5 that were late in the fourth quarter. And then I just have a couple comments on the bond sale. Are there questions on room tax here before I move on? Okay. We've been working for 5 months on this bond and note sale. I've just signed off on the last official statement tonight during this meeting that shows that there's 2 sets of notes that are going to be sold later this month. Short-term 1-year bands, and there's 1 bond issue that's being priced that will sell at the end of this month. I sat with Moody's last week and had our conference call that establishes our Moody's rating for the next issue. It was a very amicable call. We had answered all their questions ahead of time. My practice has been to try to get them responses to their questions at least 48 hours ahead of the meeting, because that tends to make the phone conference much shorter. We did that, and the phone conference only lasted about 15 minutes, and we could have ended it there, but we talked about another 15 minutes on certain things that we could do differently to help achieve a better bond rating, which is that AAA bond rating, which after having that discussion with that person, the Moody's rep, I realized we're probably never going to get that AAA rating, but it's always good to ask those questions what we could do. So we had the Moody's rating call last week. I get a phone call tomorrow at 11 o'clock that tells us what our Moody's rating will be. I'm almost certain, about 99.9% certain, that we're going to keep our current rating, which is a good thing. She as much said so on the phone call, even though I don't have it in writing yet. So I will send that out probably tomorrow or the next day to you when I let you know what kind of credit rating we got. I don't think it'll change. The bonds will be sold on Thursday, January 28th. So let's hope interest rates don't move around too much. This is a great time to borrow money. And the proceeds from the bonds and the notes will be received on February 18th. And that's the closing day of both the bonds and the notes. So okay. There any questions on that?
Any questions?
And those are the 3 things I highlighted to bring to you tonight. Thank you for your attention at 8:25 in the evening.
Thank you, Rick. Good report. Thank you.
You're welcome. Let me stop sharing.
All right. So we'll continue with our agenda. Are there any resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda? Seeing none, let's go to our standing committee reports, starting with the Workforce Diversity and Standing and Special Committees, starting with the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee. I'm Corman Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We did not have a meeting since our last legislative meeting. Our next WDIC meeting is next Wednesday, January 27th at 3:30. And so far for the agenda, we have, we're going to be going over a history of WDIC, and I'm hoping Leslin can help us with that a bit. Kit Gebhardt is also going to help us a little bit, and I'm hoping Larry, whose last name escapes me, Larry Roberts, might be able to help us a little bit. Kathy Covert, our legislative chair, has said that she's starting to gather some information, some historical information for us. And at that point, we'll also be nominating and voting for a vice chair for WDIC for 2021, and we'll be discussing the schedule for the coming year. We're going to be going to every other month, and I thought maybe we would start January and then skip a month, but I'll let Henry, who's our vice chair, speak to that if he has any other thoughts about that or if there's anything else I missed.
Nope.
Okay.
No.
All right. Thank you, Annie. Thank you, Henry. Anything else? Any questions for Annie? All right. Thanks. Moving on. Thank you for chairing the committee, Annie. Tiger Committee, Martha Robertson, chair.
Thank you, Leslin. our last meeting was January 6th. That date may ring a bell. And, you know, we left the meeting and then, you know, I don't know if other people also just kind of turned on the news and, you know, the world was exploding. So it actually was one of those meetings where we couldn't really nail down speakers. So we ended up talking quite a bit among ourselves. And it was well spent. And we did pass this resolution, talked about this resolution on the Blue Ribbon Commission. our next meeting is February 3rd. You know, I haven't really polled the committee yet about the next committee yet about date and time. So I do want to look at that, because especially the issue of setting agendas is kind of an issue. I'm hoping very, very much that we can still have Amanda Spellacy come and speak with us. I did talk to her the other day. One idea was I wanted to have us send Majority Leader Schumer a letter and maybe a little gift, such as, for example, an Ithaca is Gorgeous mask. They sell at Sunny Days. So I've gotten the mailing address, and I hope we can I'll draft a letter that we can send around, and I hope we can get 13 signatures on that. Just congratulating, you know, as a not as a partisan issue, but just as a, wow, look where New York is. So I thought that was, I hope that we can do that, and I'll get that done soon. So anyway, the committee, stay tuned, and I will send out a note soon about in the next day or two about looking for a date. And when it is about, you know, the timing and the cycle needed to set the agenda ahead of time. So that's kind of what's hanging out there.
Any questions for Martha? Nope. Thank you.
Thanks.
Let's move on to Housing and Economic Development Committee. Mike Sigler, Vice Chair.
So we obviously have not met since Anna's departure, so we have a meeting coming up on the 28th at 9:30. Martha's going to obviously be talking, taking over that committee as the chair just 3 days later. So I'm going to be contacting her to see kind of what she wants on the agenda. I know that we were talking a lot about adding two slots to the IDA, certainly something that we're going to talk about. I've contacted the county attorney about that and kind of see what else she wants to talk about. So I figure I'll call her probably around noon tomorrow. I don't think she's got anything on her calendar for that. And, you know, just call her right then and get that on the agenda. So that's about it.
Sounds like a conversation that needs to happen offline. I'm missing Thank you, Mike. Any questions? Nope, none. Downtown Facilities Committee, Dave McKenna, Chair. There you go, being all powerful and profound, Dave.
Sorry about that. Anyway, we met last Thursday afternoon, and most of the meeting was under executive session. However, we did pass minutes from several previous meetings, and no action was taken when we came out of the executive session. We will meet the 11th of February at 3 p.m. instead of 4. And that's my report.
All right, February 11th at 3 p.m. Any questions for Dave? All right. Thank you, Dave. Public Safety Committee, Rich John, Chair.
Thank you, Leslyn. The Public Safety Committee will be meeting this Thursday at 3 o'clock. One of the subjects we're going to have at the meeting is a presentation from the Cattell Center on a proposal for parole reform in New York State called the Less is More Act. And this is a piece of legislation to try to align some of the practices of parole officers with other things that really we're trying to do here in terms of alternatives to incarceration, graduated response. And if you look at our jail numbers, they've all come down in all categories except parole. Parole hasn't seemed to recognize the pandemic. They violate. There's about a 60% failure rate on parole where the people go back to prison. You know, some of that you can expect, but New York State is really not competitive with other states on how they're managing parole. That percentage is way out of line. I think it's going to be a very interesting discussion as a result of that. I'd also note, Martha, you mentioned earlier the jail numbers. We're at 32 in our jail with 2 board outs. So, again, we're maintaining very, very low numbers just on a historical basis. And that's my report. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Rich. Any questions for Rich? Okay. Moving on. Health and Human Services Committee, Shauna Black, Chair.
Thank you very much, Leslie. Let's see here. We met January 12th at 10 a.m., and we had a report from Frank. And then we also had a report from Lenny Barger from the Human Services Coalition, as well as Deb Dietrich and Richard Rivera from OAR came in to talk to us about their work in some of the encampments. And I do have 2 resolutions this evening. The first resolution I would like to move is Resolution F, Appropriation from Contingent Fund and Authorized County Administrator to Execute Contract with Cuga Health Systems for the Continuation of Community Surveillance Testing for Tompkins County residents related to COVID-19, ID 9824.
Seconded by Glenn Morey. Any questions on the resolution or comments, Martha?
Yeah, we had, if you're looking at page 26, there's some slight changes to the numbers and the explanation of the numbers that the Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee approved with those edits. Went to HHS first. So would those be friendly?
Yes.
They're already incorporated in the resolution.
Okay, I wasn't quite sure. Okay, all right. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Martha. Thank you, Kathy. Anyone else? Vote on the resolution.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Dan Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie McFean Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 nays.
That carries unanimously. Go ahead, Shauna.
And my second resolution this evening is Resolution G, 2021 budget transfer from the contingent fund to county administration for community outreach worker ID 9807. I move that.
Seconded by Dan Klein. Questions, comments? All right, let's take it to a vote.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Maury?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler? Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 nays.
That carries unanimously. Any other?
And for the Mr. Report, we will be meeting with our new committee members February 15th at 1 p.m. We are going to keep the same date and time. And I will reach out to committee members over the next week or so, so that we can review the last year's goals and set forth new goals. Thank you all.
Any other questions for Shauna on HHS report? No. Thank you. Facilities and Infrastructure Committee, Mike Lane, Chair.
Yes, we'll be meeting again Thursday, the day after tomorrow, at 9 o'clock. We have a fairly light agenda, but we're going to be talking about things like goals for next year. We have the luxury of having the same membership this coming year as we had last year. So we can talk about these things and discuss about how we performed last year and where we're going. So I don't expect a long meeting, but I think it's important that we meet.
Excellent. Thank you, Mike. Any questions for Mike? Okay. Government Operations Committee, Amanda Champion, Chair.
Yeah, thank you. We have not met since the last legislature meeting, but we will have our next meeting on February 4th. We're trying to keep the same day, but we might adjust the time a little bit, so I'm still waiting to hear back from some committee members. We'll probably be talking more about the rules of the legislature. I think we are to a place with the next set that we will have a vote on that. And I'm not sure what else is on there other than also talking about our priorities for the coming year. So there's that, and I do have a resolution.
Any questions for Amanda on her report? Go ahead with your resolution.
All right. That's Resolution H, appropriation from contingent fund terminal pay assessment department ID 9783.
May I have a second, please? Seconded by Dan Klein. Any discussion? Okay. Vote.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Ann Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Maury?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 nays.
All right. Thank you. Anything else, Amanda?
Nope. That's it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Moving on to Planning, Energy, and Environmental Quality Committee, Deborah Dawson, Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll be meeting on Monday, the 25th. We will be having a presentation from Rachel Carpetella, who is the Director of Commercial Heating Systems for Sustainable Westchester, which is apparently the model sustainability program in New York State. Thanks to Brian Eden for putting me in touch with Rachel. Anyone who's interested is welcome to attend. Rachel's presentation will be starting at 3. Meanwhile, I want to thank Barbara Ekstrom and Amanda Champion for their work on the environmentally preferred procurement policy. I want to thank Amanda particularly for how she's pushed the county to clean up its act with single-use plastics and styrofoam and the like. I want to thank all the people on the committee. We've had a really good committee joining us starting in February, not just as a member, but as the chair. And I'm really happy to be turning the committee over to someone who is so particularly well-equipped to address the technical energy issues that we'll be emphasizing most likely moving forward under the CLCPA. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Deborah. Any questions for Deborah? Nope. Moving on, Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee, Martha Robertson, Chair.
Thank you, Leslie. I have one thing for on Under Peak, which is at Rob Mojica's press conference today, somebody asked him about the CLCPA and was that going to be funded. He said, yes, it's fun. The investments are funded in the budget. Nothing slows down, assuming the federal money comes through. They have added staff to be able to meet the goals, although Deborah and I have talked many times about it's not just about how you hold the Zoom meetings, but the real big dollar investments we're still not sure about. But last budget meeting was January 11th, and we passed a number of, a few resolutions that we've already dealt with. I noticed that if the next budget committee meeting follows the same timing, that would be February 8th, a Monday. And I have on here that that's committee meetings for NYSAC. I don't know what the NYSAC schedule is for the committee meetings or whatever else is going on that day. But Deborah, when if you're looking at the budget committee, I wonder is that something to check?
Yeah, I didn't realize that, Martha. I will check it. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Thanks a million. So, and I look forward to working with you on budget.
Thanks. I'll be picking your brain, especially since I only have a year to do it.
Be careful. You might get, I don't know what you're going to get.
Any questions for Deborah? For Martha, sorry.
Thanks.
Ann?
It's not exactly a question, but it's a comment. Just to let you know, Deborah, Martha's attached. I've shared a room with her at a conference. She'll answer your call, I bet you, at any time of day or night, just about.
You bet.
All right. Thank you. Thank you to everyone who chaired committees this year and who will be transitioning. We really appreciate your steadfast leadership on these committees. Are there any member files, resolutions? There were none. Minutes of the previous meeting, the January 5th meeting, moved by Martha Robertson. May I have a second, please? Dan Klein. Any discussion, corrections, deletions on the minutes? Mm-hmm. No. Let's vote on them.
Henry Granison.
Did we move them?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Henry Granison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Arthur Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sigler? Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 no.
Thank you. The minutes carry. There's no other unfinished business. May I have a motion to go into executive session for the purposes of discussing personnel matters related to a particular person? Moved by Shauna Black, seconded by Deborah Dawson. All in favor of going into executive session? If not,
Henry Grandison?
Yes.
Rich John?
Yes.
Dan Klein?
Yes.
Ann Corman?
Yes.
Mike Lane?
Yes.
Dave McKenna?
Yes.
Glenn Morey?
Yes.
Martha Robertson?
Yes.
Mike Sidwick?
Yes.
Shauna Black?
Yes.
Amanda Champion?
Yes.
Deborah Dawson?
Yes.
Leslie McBean Claiborne?
Yes.
13 ayes, 0 noes.
The executive session is called. We do not, will not be taking any action and will not intend to take action when we get up to executive session. So we'll move directly to adjournment.